Okay. Good. So, the subject of this work, what Cossi and Nicol Ciuchi's theory, is somewhat removed from the main topic of the workshop. But in the last year, there have been at least a couple instances where a connection to integrability seems to have appeared. Now, of the two connections, one might be a little bit accidental in the sense that we spent a lot of time studying the SU2 Hitching equations, which reduced to Sinch-Gordon in certain circumstances. And at the same, recently, Aldai and Maldacena needed to study the Sinch-Gordon equation as a way to produce minimal surfaces in ADS3, and hence compute strong coupling limit of gluon scattering amplitudes for any four supermills. And some of our results just happened to be exactly what they needed. So they could get some of our formula. But there are some indications. I mean, if you want to generalize their work in the most naive way, you probably need other of the formula we have. And also there are some indications that our ideas and approach might turn out to be useful for broader generalizations of their work, maybe to the integrable systems involved in minimal surfaces for ADS4 and ADS5. Also, in last talk I heard of Maldacena, he was hinting that some of these features might survive at weak coupling. The other connection is that at some point in the work, we met a set of integral equations which are essentially identical in form to thermodynamic Bethe ansatz equations. So we don't know if there is an integrable system behind these equations. What we know is that we surely hope that the sort of experience that have been accumulated in integrable systems for solving and studying these sort of equations might be useful to us. Furthermore, these TBA equations were given to us by the Gitch theory together with a set of partial differential equations satisfied by what plays the role of the Y functions. We have not seen these sort of equations in the integrable system literature, but they would probably be there for other integrable systems. So who knows, maybe the flow of information can go both ways. Now, so the outline of the talk is pretty straightforward. I'm going to spend a good number of slides on giving a background of what the world-crossing problem is. Then I will show you how some TBA-like equations arise when you study hyperkähler matrix on certain manifolds. And then the sort of WKB analysis of the SU2 Hitching system, which was useful to Aldai and Maldacena. I'll try to keep the topics well connected, but the time is what it is, and the subject is pretty long and sometimes a bit technical. So we'll see. Now, Nicol Ciuchi's theory is in four dimensions. Some basic facts. Nicol Ciuchi's supersymmetry mixes vector multiplets, mixes gauge fields with complex scalars. So every time you have a gauge field, you also have a complex scalar in the joint representation. And there is a natural Coulomb branch in which this complex scalar assumes expectation values, which break the gauge group down to some abelian subalgebra. So in this Coulomb branch, the theory typically looks like a bunch of massless U1 gauge fields. And the states of the theory are labeled by electric and magnetic charges for these U1 gauge fields. There is a natural symplectic product in the space of charges, which will appear other places in the talk, so I'll just write it here. Now, an Nicol Ciuchi supersymmetry gives you a BPS bound that essentially tells you that particles with states which carry charge also will be massive. So the BPS bound tells you the mass of a state is greater or equal to the absolute value of the central charge of that state. The central charge is the linear combination of the electric and magnetic charges, whose coefficients are function on the moduli space of the Coulomb branch. Essentially, these A's are the superpartners of the U1 gauge fields. And you can think of the ADs as functions of the A's. And this functional relation between the two essentially determines the masses Lagrangian completely. This is all what the sub-evident story is about. But today I don't care much about the masses Lagrangian. I care about the massive BPS spectrum, the spectrum of particles which saturate this BPS bound. So the set to the mass is equal to the absolute value of the central charge. Now, VPS particles sit in reduced multiplets of supersymmetry. And it often happens that when this is the case, you can construct some index which counts these short representations and not the long representations. So, and it's robust as you vary the model of your theory. Now, these sort of index theorems have a weak point. They usually fail when a continuum of states comes down and touches your discrete. And this is the case here. So although these BPS degeneracy should not naively vary, they actually do vary when you cross certain codimension walls in modular space. Essentially, whenever the central charges of two different particles, or particles with different charge align, it is possible for these particles to, for a particle of charge, say, Q, to disappear from the spectrum. So, in a sense, VPS states can decay across the wall of marginal stability. Or more precisely, they can combine with some states on the continuum to form some long representations and then go away from the BPS bound. So the problem is to understand this decay process. So the question you want to understand is which particles will disappear, which particles will appear when I cross a wall of marginal stability? This is the wall crossing problem. Now, why do you even believe that you should be able to give a universal answer to this problem? Well, if a state is disappearing from the spectrum because it mixes with a continuum of multiparticle states, you might expect that near the wall of marginal stability, the state should be pretty large in size. And in particular, there is some hope that the effective mass stress Lagrangian will actually be able to tell you something about the decay process. Now, this general hope was made more concrete by work of Deneff and then Deneff-Moore, which essentially managed to determine how many particles do you lose or gain, which can be made as a bound state of two other particles. And there was a certain wall-crossing formula. So essentially they said that the change in the number of particles of charge Q1 plus Q2 will be given by the symplectic product of the charges times the number of particles of type Q1, number of particles of type Q2. But it seemed to be very hard to get a universal formula which considers all possible multiparticle processes. Still, about last year, Konsevich and Soderman wrote down a beautiful wall-crossing formula in a completely different mathematical setup, which turned out to be working exceptionally well for n equal 2 field theories, at least for the field theories for which the BPS spectrum was actually known, so the wall-crossing could be studied and checked. The wall-crossing formula of Konsevich and Soderman takes a very, very surprising form. Essentially, if you want to compute the jumps in the BPS spectra across the wall, you need to consider a set of formal variables, XQ, labeled by a charge, which satisfies some simple multiplicative property. And consider this, what we'll call the Konsevich-Soderman transformation, a sort of coordinate transformation associated to a charge, which multiplies the coordinates with a different charge by these powers of -1 minus x. It is a very simple transformation. And Konsevich and Soderman instructed us to take this transformation, raise it to the power of the number of BPS states with the charge, and take the composition of these transformations in the order of the phase of the central charge. Okay. And the prediction was that this overall composition over all the charges would be continuous across walls of marginal stability. So something very funny is going on here, because these individual factors do not commute. But when you cross a wall of marginal stability, which is essentially a place where the argument of two central charges align, well, it means that the order of the two central charges was different on one side and on the other side of the wall. So you want to compose the corresponding factors in a different order, but they do not commute. So the changes in the BPS degeneracies are exactly such that they compensate for this lack of commutativity. Now let me give you a concrete example. A very simple theory where I have one electron and one monopole. And the prediction of wall crossing is that on the other side of a wall, if the central charges are behaving in an appropriate way, I get an electron, a monopole, and the dion, a bound state of an electron and a monopole. Now, in terms of this constitutional Wolff crossing formula, you consider the transformation associated to an electron, which takes the, so there is what you could call an electric coordinate and a magnetic coordinate. Transformation multiplies the magnetic coordinate by 1 minus the electric coordinate. Then there is the transformation for the monopole, which modifies the electric coordinate, divides it by 1 minus the magnetic coordinate. Okay, these are very simple transformations. And it's, you can just check by hand that this composition, the composition in this order, equals the composition in the other order if you add an extra factor in the middle. Now, if you play around with this identity a little bit, you can rewrite it as a pentagon identity. Something like, so there is a sort of beautiful recursion relation for some variables, xn minus 1 times xn plus 1 equals 1 minus xn. And the pentagon identity tells you that this sequence have period 5, which is kind of surprising until you actually check it. And some of you might have seen this sort of recursion relation already in studying some TBA equations. There are other types of interesting Wolff crossing identities which happen in field theories. For example, if on the side of the wall you have an electron and a dion, such that the symplectic product is 2 instead of being 1, on the other side of the wall you'll find an infinite tower of dionic states together with this funny extra factor which represents a W boson. Minus 2 is just because it has 2 helicities and spin is shifted by 1/2 with respect to a basic scalar multiplet. Now, if you try to understand this, if you want to understand this Wolff crossing relation, you can consider this other sequence. This is not periodic, but it has a very simple relation between the asymptotics at plus infinity and the asymptotics at minus infinity, which gives you this extra factor here. Anyway, so Concepts Soman give you all these sort of funny identities, and you check, and there are field theories for which these identities are actually true. For example, a Schuchert theory with no matter has a strong coupling region where there is a single electron and a single, let's say a monopole and a dion, and a weakly coupled region of the moduli space where there is a W boson and all these infinite tower of monopoles. Now, how do we understand this sort of Wolff crossing formula? Let me start with the simplest possible Nikola-Tsugich theory, without any massive particle, just the pure U1 gauge theory. And let me put it on R3 crosses 1. So in 4 dimensions, this theory has a has a complex scalar and a gauge field. It has a very trivial moduli space parameterized by this complex scalar. In terms of this A and AD, which we had before in the central charge, A is just the scalar, and AD is the scalar multiplied by the gauge coupling. So there is a very simple functional relation. Now, if you go down to 3 dimensions, the Wilson line of the gauge field around this circle will give you an extra scalar. And furthermore, the 3-dimensional gauge field can also be dualized to a 4th scalar. So you have a moduli space, which is essentially R2 times T2. Now, there is a natural complex structure in this space where you have this complex gauge field and you combine the 2 circles into complex torus, an elliptic curve with parameter tau. But this is a Perkeller manifold in a very trivial way, same way as R4 is. So it has actually a CP1 world of different complex structures, which I'll parameterize in terms of an inhomogeneous coordinate on CP1, zeta. In complex structure zeta, the holomorphic coordinates on this manifold are of this form. You see, you sort of combine a circle with a certain piece of A to make a C star, C star times C star. Now, the reason I'm writing down these 2 coordinates explicitly is because the beautiful fact we realize is that when you add particles to your theory, massive particles to this theory, these holomorphic functions get modified in a very beautiful fashion. So let me now consider a U1 gauge theory plus 1 massive particle, 1 massive electrically charged particle, say charge 1 or charge 2. Now, even in 4 dimensions, You know, there is a running coupling constant once you add a charged particle. The gauge coupling runs, and essentially you can write it as a function of the Coulomb branch parameter as logarithm of A over some scale. And so the gauge coupling diverges in the infrared. This theory is not asymptotically free, but we don't care much about, just look at it as an effective theory for something else. So it doesn't really make sense for A bigger than L. Well, sorry, there should have been a minus here. Some 2 pi I factors, just forget about it. Anyway, the point is that, so you see that if you do a naive dimensional reduction from 4 dimensions to 3 dimensional circle, because the gauge coupling is running, you can see that the radius of the magnetic circle becomes a function of A and shrinks as you go towards A equal to 0. You have the naive dimensional reduction of the 4-dimensional theory has a singularity at A equal to 0 due to the fact that this particle actually has mass A. Remember, it's an electrically charged particle, so there is only QA in the expression for the central charge and for the mass. But if you remember that you actually had this circle, so you were in R3 cross S1, you should realize that you should include the effect of the particle running in loops around the circle. In other terms, this particle in 3 dimensions actually receives contributions to the mass, not just from the 4-dimensional mass, but also from the Wilson loop, for the Wilson line T. So you actually expect something to happen only when both A and T are 0, not when A is equal to 0. And indeed, the full quantum corrected metric for the 3-dimensional theory, it's actually smooth and regular, and it looks like a periodic, like a tab knot locally. So you have a circle that's shrinking, but it's shrinking to dimension 3 in a smooth way. So this periodic Tabnat metric is an Epperkeller metric, which is a circle vibration. It's a very simple metric. There is a 3-dimensional base space parameterized by these coordinates I call x here, and a circle, and it depends only on an harmonic potential on this base and on a corresponding vector potential. In this case, we have a periodic Tabnat in the sense that the base space is R2 cross S1 parameterized by this complex field A and by the electric Wilson line, T. There is a single source for this harmonic function at A equal to T equal to 0, where the particle we added becomes massless. But far away, because we are on R2 cross S1, this potential behaves logarithmically. So far away, you see, again, the sort of behavior of the four-dimensional theory, but the metric is smooth and regular as small a. Now, it takes a little bit of work, but actually, it took us quite some work. But you can write down a nice set of holomorphic functions in complex structure zeta on this Epperkeller manifold, this periodic Tabnat space. One of the two natural complex coordinates is very natural, it's very simple, it's the one we already had for R2 cos t2. But the magnetic coordinate gets modified, so there is this extra correction term, which takes the form of a simple kernel, an integration kernel, convoluted with the logarithm of 1 minus the electric coordinate. Now, these equations should remind you more of a thermodynamic Bethe-Ansatz equation, although not for... this is just a toy model. It's just this U1 theory with a massive particle. It's not a full asymptotically free theory, but... Our basic question was, how do we modify these equations for a general case when I have a gauge theory where I have a whole tower of electrically, magnetically charged particles? Now, before I go there, let me just remark a few simple properties of this expression. First of all, we picked this coordinate. Of course, there is a certain freedom. You can always multiply this coordinate by some function of this other coordinate, you're free to pick whatever coordinates you want on your space. But we like this particular one because it has very clean asymptotics when zeta goes to 0 and infinity. So this correction term is integrated on a line such that the correction is actually very small for large zeta and small zeta. By the way, the price to pay for having uniform asymptotics, though, is that you must have discontinuities. So you have discontinuity on the true rays over which you are integrating, clearly, because the integration, the pole passes across the integration path. They are at, there is this positive real line and negative real line. And the discontinuity takes exactly the form of a Ks factor. See? It's, on the real, positive real line, the discontinuity is identical to the Ks factor produced by, associated to an electrically charged particle, which is exactly the particle we had added to our theory. And on the negative axis, you find the Ks factor for the antiparticle. So something is definitely brewing here. So our conjecture was that if you had, say, an electron and a monopole, it would be pretty hard to write down what the corrected quantum corrected moduli space is just because you don't have a Lagrangian. You cannot write down a Lagrangian with an electrically charged particle and a magnetically charged particle. So it's pretty hard to compute the sort of corrections you get when you have loops of electrons and monopoles. So we didn't do that. Instead, we conjectured that the correct answer should take this form. The flat space result, the result without particles added, plus corrections which take the form of the usual kernel convoluted with other logarithm of 1 minus the electric coordinate, logarithm of 1 minus the magnetic coordinate. So we wrote down a generic formula for a theory with a general BPS spectrum. So we had these functions of zeta, these holomorphic functions on the moduli space in complex structure of zeta, labeled by a charge, which have this is the flat sort of the expression you'd have if you had no BPS particles, and then a correction for each BPS particle, which takes form of an appropriate kernel convoluted with logarithm of 1 minus chi. Now this is exactly the form of a TBA equation, the monomic Bethe-Ansatz equation. If you want to write down establish a dictionary, you would need to write this zeta as something like e to the rapidity, probably times a phase, which is the phase of A or phase of AD. And the integration kernel would take the form of a cosh over sinh or something like that. But as I said, I don't have a precise understanding of how or what sort of integrable system will give you these equations. But I know that if you tell me how to study this theory, I can learn more about the Perkeller metric on this manifold. Now, this function still have good asymptotics. The asymptotics at zeta equal to zero or zeta goes to infinity are very simple. The logarithm goes like 1 over zeta at zero, towards zero, like zeta at infinity. Because again, this correction was taken so that it's exponentially small at large zeta and at small zeta. The discontinuities are compatible with these asymptotics. Essentially, we put these integration lines across which you have discontinuities exactly so that this correction factor will be exponentially small at large zeta and at small zeta. There is something, so once you compute these functions, once you solve these TVA-like equations, how do you reconstruct the metric? Well, look, it's relatively easy to see that this transformation preserves this very simple symplectic form. This means that if I take those solutions and I plug them in this symplectic form, the symplectic form is going to be continuous, because the discontinuities are given by the Ks factors, but the Ks factors preserve the symplectic form. So the symplectic form has no discontinuities as a function of zeta. If you plug in the asymptotics, you see that it has only a simple pole at zero and a simple pole at infinity. So it should have this three-term expansion as a function of zeta. And these three symplectic forms are the hyperkähler forms on the manifold and determine the metric. Now, how does wall crossing come about now? Well, we said that across certain lines on the zeta plane, there are discontinuities given by these Ks factors. And the location of these lines depend on the phases of the central charges. So as you move around in the moduli space, your discontinuity lines across when you cross a wall will try to pass across each other. Now, this would be a problem. This would give you a sort of discontinuity in your solution, unless the product of the discontinuities for the various lines is actually continuous across this wall. And the Ks formula exactly guarantees that. It tells you that whenever a bunch of lines, discontinuities, pass across each other, the overall discontinuity across this group of lines is continuous. So the Ks formula becomes, the wall crossing formula becomes a consistency condition for this TBA equation to have a solution which is continuous as a function of the moduli space. So the integral equation is continuous, the solution will be continuous, and then the metric will be continuous. So, in a sense, we conjecture this formula as a way to connect the continuity of the metric and the wall crossing phenomena. Now, how do you prove such a conjecture? How do you prove that this is actually the correct way of extracting the metric on the moduli space of a gauge theory? Because, I mean, it's fine to conjecture things, but how would you prove that? Well, what you can show, so this integral equation is essentially equivalent to a certain Riemann-Hilbert problem. You're given with the problem of finding some functions of zeta which have prescribed discontinuities across lines on the zeta plane. And when you have a Riemann-Hilbert problem, you can often find a differential equation associated to it. And that's the case here, too. It's relatively easy to show that if you take, for example, the derivative of chi with respect of zeta, you can rewrite it as a certain differential operator acting on chi, which is a very simple zeta dependence. The coefficients are all differential operators in the angles, in these Wilson line angles. And also you can show that because the discontinuity, these Ks factors, do not depend on anything. They don't depend on the radius. They don't depend on the moduli. You can also write a set of partial differential equations which give you the dependence of the chi's on the radius and on the other moduli. And all these differential equations commute among each other. This is sort of I don't know what it is in the language of integrable systems, but this is, some statement like this would be true for the TBA equations of a general integrable system as well. If you rewrite the TBA equations as a Riemann-Hilbert problem, you can then convert the Riemann-Hilbert problem into a differential problem. Now, the usefulness of this for us was that we could find the physical interpretation of each of these equations. Now, this set of equations is equivalent to the set of integral equations. And then we realized that this equation was just the RG flow of the four-dimensional theory. This equation was some sort of anomalous R-symmetry, transformation of the anomalous R-symmetry of the four-dimensional theory. And these were the Cauchy-Riemann equations for the hyperkähler metric. So if you want to prove this integral equation from the point of view of four-dimensional gauge theory, you would start with the statement that these differential equations should exist. And then you would go to the Riemann-Hilbert problem, and then you would go to the integral equation. This together with some information about the large radius asymptotics. Okay, so I just leave it at that. I think that this might be interesting to. Okay. as it works. Okay, fine. So now, so this is the first, this concludes the second part of the talk. So we found these TBA equations, TBA-like equations. We don't know if they have a direct relation to an integrable system, but they seem to be fun to study. There are this interesting wall crossing, they're associated with this interesting wall crossing phenomena as you vary the moduli. And they're associated to this set of differential equations, which might be interesting from your point of view too. And from my point of view, I would love if I could get some feedback on how to study, how to understand these sort of equations and their properties. Sorry, this is just the exponential of this sort of expression. So is So it's r zeta times the central charge of the particle plus I times an angle plus r zeta. So this is like e to the like if you were at infinite size, you would have no corrections, and this would be the naive answer. And this is the finite size correction to the... Well, it's still labeled by gamma because, you see, for example, if this gamma was an electric charge, you would have inside A, you would have AD, if this was a magnetic charge. Anyway, so after we found this sort of physical proof of the wall crossing formula, we really wanted to find some good examples of it because, we had to make some assumptions to justify the existence of these differential equations. I wanted to see if this was actually working in practice. Also, if I look at this differential equation, it's an integral equation. It's pretty clear that it's going to have a solution at very large radius where the corrections are small and you can work in a sort of iterative, you can just solve it iteratively. But it was far from clear that the solution would exist at all values of the radius. So that was also part of the question. Could you find a way to describe this function sky directly without going through the integral equation, or at least show that they would exist. Yeah, well, whatever. So it turns out that for a lot of three-dimensional gauge theory, there is a construction, four-dimensional gauge theory, sorry, there is a construction of the moduli space of the theory compactified on a circle. This construction goes through the Hitchin equations. So Hitchin equations are a set of equations for a connection in a joint one form on a Riemann surface, say on a sphere or a torus. For now, I will take this connection to be an SU2 valued connection. Now, the Hitchin equations are equivalent to the flatness of this auxiliary connection. And there is a finite dimensional moduli space of solution to these Hitchin equations with specified boundary conditions, which is hyperkähler. And it coincides with the moduli space of certain four-dimensional gauge theories. So now, the monodrawing data of this auxiliary connection gives you the holomorphic functions in complex structure zeta on this manifold. So our question was to find some combination of the monodromy data which would produce the chi gammas, which would produce the chis for this particular problem. Some combination of the monodromy data, which could be then determined from this sort of integral equations directly without having to solve Hitchin system. Now, I don't have time to go to the precise details of how things work for the Hitchin system, but actually a lot of the content of what we did, a lot of the ideas of what we did, emerge from a remain, even if you take a very simple limit of the Hitchin system, sort of a conformal limit in which you send r to 0 and zeta to 0 while keeping the ratio fixed. In this limit, the Hitchings, this flat connection essentially becomes just an holomorphic Schrödinger equation. So in the remaining 7 or whatever minutes I have, I would like to show you how from studying the holomorphic Schrödinger equation, you could find this sort of generalized TVA equations, sorry, this sort of TVA equations. Actually, I suspect that something like this is done. I've seen something similar in the literature last week, in the iterable system literature last week, so this should be familiar to some of you. So suppose I have a holomorphic Schrödinger equation, a Schrödinger equation on the complex plane, with a polynomial potential, goes like w to the k. And I want to, I'm just asking the question, how does the scattering data of this Schrödinger equation behave as a function of h-bar? So if h-bar is a complex variable, what is the scattering data as a function of h-bar? Now, these solutions of this equation have a very simple behavior at large w. They typically grow exponentially. But of course, in each direction, if you pick a direction in W plane, you can look for a solution which actually decreases exponentially. And you can start studying the Stokes phenomena for this problem, meaning that there are several sectors in the W plane. In each sector, you can find a unique solution which is asymptotically decreasing in the corresponding sector. And it will typically grow be exponentially growing in all other sectors. Now, if you compare the solutions from nearby sectors, you see that in the sector I, fi plus 1 and f minus I minus 1 will be both exponentially growing at the same rate. Their difference, if you normalize them properly, is exponentially decreasing, so it should be a multiple of the solution associated with this sector. This coefficient here, the coefficient in this relation, is the scattering data of the problem, and is what we want to determine as a function of h, possibly without having to solve the Schrödinger equation. It's possible to write as this scattering data just in terms of the Wronskian of these various solutions. Now, if you look at the linear potential, the problem is just too easy. If you try to compare solutions on sector 1 and sector 3, but say sector 1 and sector 3 are adjacent because there are only 3 sectors. And it's easy to see that these functions are just constant. They're equal to I or minus I. If you look at the quadratic potential, the harmonic oscillator, you can already find something interesting going on. So this function will grow exponentially this way. There are some relations between the scattering data. So, for example, the scattering data in a certain direction and the one in the opposite direction are related in a simple way. So at the end, there is a single scattering function, and all the other ones can be reconstructed from that one to relations of this sort. So the idea is that to determine this function of h, I should determine how it behaves at small h bar. It's regular for finite h bar. It has no poles, and typically, the real question is how does it behave when h bar goes to zero? Now, it's a semi-classical limit, and I can use the WKB analysis for that. So the WKB approximation to a solution is to say that the logarithm of the function has a WKB phase over h plus corrections. And this phase satisfies the equation that the square of the derivative should be equal to the potential. So the idea is that to do the WKB approximation, to transport a solution around the path, you just have to integrate the square root of V along the path. Now, this approximation can be good or could be bad. It only depends on your choice of path. As long as you follow a path where the solution is exponentially growing, it never gets mixed with the other solution, which is exponentially decreasing. Your approximation is relatively good. But if you ever make the mistake of following a path for which the phase decreases, the real part of the phase decreases, then your approximation breaks down. So the question is, can we compare the small sections in different sectors, the solutions in different sectors, along WKB paths. Well, let's look at the paths for this harmonic oscillator. Depending on the value of the phase of H, with respect of M, this is the shape of the WKB lines. You see, if you want to compare, say, the solution on the sector 1 and the solution on the sector 3, you can do it easily along this path here. But you cannot do it here. Vice versa, here you'll be able to use the approximation to relate the function in the sector 2 and the function in the sector 4 instead. So for certain values of the phase of H, one of the scattering data has simple asymptotics for small h, and the other doesn't. And vice versa for other values of the phase of H. It's actually useful to define a new function, x, which agrees with the scattering data, which has good asymptotics, so that this x has good asymptotics on the whole h-bar plane. The price is that, well, it's discontinuous when you go from this sort of configuration to this sort of configuration of WKB lines. And the discontinuity is, again, given exactly by the KS factors. So you can actually write the answer as a contour integral without having to solve the harmonic oscillator. Well, you could solve it exactly, but you could have gotten this result just from the analytic properties in H-bar. And the important point is that this extends to whatever other potential you want, polynomial potential you want. Now, for the Hitchin system, the WKB analysis goes through in a very similar fashion. It's actually easier to study because in the case of the Schrödinger equation, the semi-classical method gives you the behavior at small h-bar, and then you have to work more to get the behavior at large h-bar. But in the Hitchin system, the semi-classical method applies both at small zeta and at large zeta. So, so what we did was to find an appropriate generalization of these choices of variables made here for general Hitchin systems to produce some monodromy data which had good asymptotics uniformly in H-bar. And we found that the discontinuities were always given by KS factors for the spectrum or the appropriate four-dimensional gauge theory. Yes, I mean, there would be a differential equation in H-bar. Well, it depends what you mean as writing it. So it will exist. The coefficients of this differential equation, which are these differential operators in the angles, well, you don't know. Finding these coefficients is equivalent to solving that integral equation. But they do solve, because these differential equations are all compatible, they do satisfy interesting differential equations themselves. So the derivative respect of the radius of this A, for example, will be some nonlinear, some sort of generalized Pan-Levé system. Ah, by the way, I forgot. These sort of equations are very related, very similar to the ones you find in Chakotin-Wafa. So in that case, you don't have differential operators, but you have finite dimensional matrices. Again, we don't know why, but to maybe just really. Yeah. So, sorry? Whatever. But we only understand that you need at least one puncture. Let's say a sphere with at least three or four, or you can do irregular singularity. So you can do a sphere with a single irregular singularity. This would be the polynomial potential, for example. Or whatever you want. We only understand that just because the WKB approximation for connections of higher rank is a bit harder. We have some conjectures of how it would work, but we don't have a good proof. Yeah. Well, okay. So you can solve the Hitchin equations, but it's equivalent to solving P-cinch Gordon. Anyway, so this method, if you ever want to compute the, well, so for Aldai Maldacena had cinch Gordon equation, okay, and had to compute essentially this sort of scattering phases for the Hitchin system, and well, because we had this sort of discontinuity, which also we already saw in periodic tabnut, the answer was just that their solution, I mean, that the functions they were looking for were just the ones for periodic tabnut, and so they used them. Okay.
We are about on time, so there is time for questions or more answers.
So that sounds very interesting, connection between TBA and differential equation, which we heard in the second part. But actually, this part is known, what you told us about. That started with Warras in the 90s and continues with Dorian, Tateo, and other people. And so we understand connection in massless case, conformal limit. But nobody understands how to write them in the full case when you have two terms on here.
You understand Schrödinger?
Yeah, well, for the when the, you have not cosine hyperbolic, but
right. So this
just one term.
Yeah.
That is not.
Yeah.
You're saying that you have. Relationship between Schrödinger equation, some Schrödinger equation, and TBA system, which correspond to non-conformal case. Is it a statement or not?
No, the statement is the relation between Hitchin system and TBA equations. So I was trying to give an example, a simplified example of this relation, just because the Hitchin system has some technicalities I didn't want to dwell on. So I simplified the Hitchin system to the Schrödinger equation. And I know that so the fact that you get TBA-like equations for the Schrödinger equation, I think it's known. I'm not sure there
is. But is there a Schrödinger equation for the full case?
In the full case, it's not the Schrödinger equation; it's the Hitchin system. Hitchin equations.
Okay. Thank you.
More questions?
But maybe I should say that this limit is good enough to preserve all the information about the BPS spectrum and the wall crossing, so all of that should already appear here.
Yes. Okay, so TBA is usually comes from, I mean, it comes from some, first you need the BA, and then you can make a TBA. Do you have any idea what the BA might be here, or why there's some? Where's Young-Baxter or something?
What I see as a hint is that the radius, this would be the radius of the TBA, and it's also the radius of which I put the four-dimensional gauge theory. So, so it looks like I'm doing something to the four-dimensional theory to make it two-dimensional, and then I'm doing the computation. Now, Sanzili and Nekrasov were talking about this sort of epsilon deformation, which would reduce. So maybe the four-dimensional theorem R2 times R2 epsilon. I don't know.
And then the other question is, so of course this also appeared in work by, somehow these formulas by Aldai and Maldacena, or the problem Aldai and Maldacena solve for the Wilson loops, they took some of your, they noticed a similarity, right? And do you have any ideas why this completely different physics might be related to your system?
Well, At the moment, it's just that there was a Sinch Gordon equation in both problems. But I think that the occurrence of wall crossing might extend beyond the problem of just Sinch Gordon to other integrable systems. And, No. So there is no, as far as I see, there is no relation between this four-dimensional Winnicott Chukic theory and the Wilson loops or the Winnicott Forgic theory.
The spectrum of BPS states you described, which is related to TBA, is related to the spectrum of quantum mechanics related to n equals 2. There is a quantum mechanics related to n equals 2 Young-Mills theory, which can be constructed. The Hamiltonian is like mass minus central charge. And you can do the also BPS spectrum there. And how is it related to this BPS mass formula?
How would you get the quantum mechanics?
Well, as I said, the Hamiltonian is the P0, the mass, minus central charge, and n equals 2.
But it's not a finite dimensional quantum mechanics.
It's finite dimensional quantum mechanics.
How do you...
Okay, we can discuss later.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we should thank Davide again.